proceed to the second case of the day, Sow versus the Fortville Police Department. Mr. Conte?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Suarez Conte. I represent Mr. Muhammadu Sow, the appellant in this case. One of the first issues we raised before the court was the reluctance by the district court to exclude some of the evidence that Mr. Sow contested in the summary judgment process. This case, the district court ruling is primarily focused on the probable cause element in the Section 1983 cases. And one of the things that was done in this case was that a number of statements were obtained from certain individuals that the Fortville Police Department and the officers contended formed the basis for the probable cause in this case.
But isn't that how probable cause is determined?
Well, Your Honor, you can rely on statements made by individuals to determine probable cause, but most of the cases that have been cited were, in particular in this case, there is the case of Woods versus the City of Chicago. In that case that the appellees relied on, there was a protest against two documents. These documents were a sworn statement by a complainant and also a police report. But what we have in this case are phone call conversations between police officers and individuals in Maryland and other places. So if probable cause is a key element in this type of cases, I think the statements must bear some indicia of credibility. I think the district court was bound at least to examine protests in this case, but it never did so. So we think that that was a serious mistake on the part of the district court, and we believe it was an abuse of discretion. As I indicated, the decision of the district court is primarily based on the issue that there was no probable cause, there was probable cause to allow the arrest of Mr. Sow. Well, let's look at the facts, Your Honors. Mr. Sow is a native and citizen of Senegal. He drives around the country selling artifacts, African artifacts, in trade fair shows and other county activities. When he collects his money, instead of walking around with cash, he goes to the post office and buys money orders. And he happened to find himself in the small town of Fortville, Indiana, trying to buy a part for his vehicle. He was directed to a place where he could purchase a part. He went there and presented one of his money orders to the dealer. And the fellow indicated that, in fact, he did not have cash with him and directed Mr. Sow to a nearby post office.
But that's where it starts, right? That's where this investigation starts.
Yes.
Not from the person that sees the money order, not from somebody at a fair, but a person at a post office who issues these type of money orders.
Well,
that's where the whole investigation starts from, isn't it?
Right, Your Honor. But when she questioned Mr. Sow, Mr. Sow indicated that, look, I bought this money order from another post office in Ohio. So, there was nothing on the record to show that, in fact, these individuals were trained to examine postal money orders before they are distributed to customers.
Well,
there was nothing in the evidence to support that.
But, you know, it's so odd here. And I understand that it turned out to be legitimate money order. But they said that the watermark on it, instead of Benjamin Franklin, looked like Jesus Christ. That just seems to me pretty bizarre. And your client was not able to produce a receipt for it, although he had receipts for others. Later on, he did find a receipt, but I think had he had a receipt, this whole thing would have gone away, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, in fact, that is the problem with this case. Mr. So did not have a receipt for the particular money order, but he had a receipt for this, another money order he purchased at the same post office, the same time, the same place, the same zip code. That receipt had a phone number, and he produced that receipt at the moment and said, look, I can't find the receipt for the $1,000, but I have a receipt for the $500. You can call this post office and verify with them that, in fact, whether or not I actually purchased this money order from them. We submitted a video of the transaction at the stop. You can see Mr. So frantically trying to produce and submit the money orders, the receipt for the other money order to the police officers. They simply rejected it. In fact, one of the police officers commented that, in fact, we don't do this. You know,
police officers are pretty much relying also on those postal inspectors who, I mean, are supposed to know a good money order from a bad one when they see it. Now, they were apparently wrong here, but when they say this picture doesn't look like Benjamin Franklin.
Well, Your Honor, one thing we don't know for sure is these were clerks. They were not even people that produced. We don't know how much experience they had. We don't know how long they've been working in the post office. What the police did was
that there any evidence that they had no authority whatsoever to issue a postal money order?
Well, no, Your Honor. We did not get into that type of evidence.
So a police officer would reasonably assume that somebody at the post office, where you get the money orders, which is where Mr. So got it, should have some knowledge of what a valid money order is.
Well, Your Honor,
that's what a reasonable police officer should assume, or are you saying that's not reasonable?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is they did not stop at that. They did not just accept the words of the clerks in the post office. That is not where they stopped. They called Maryland, some office in Maryland.
But isn't that to your client's advantage instead of just taking the clerk and saying, okay, let's put him in jail. Take him away now.
Well,
they continue to ask questions.
Well, but, Your Honor, my client produced a receipt bearing the same information. If they really wanted to help my client, when he gave them that receipt and said, look, this is where I bought this money order, I think they should have at least called that post office. Because and they admit that receipt had all similar information with the post office, with the money order they were contesting. They had all the information. And this court has said that, in fact, you don't have to investigate if you receive probable cause. You don't have to investigate to exonerate the person. In this case, they decided to investigate. Did they use reasonable care? Were they reasonable under the circumstances to reject information that was readily handy from Mr. So in order to verify the authenticity of the money? I submit to the court that they did not. There was clearly easy information that would have prevented them from law.
Mr. Conte, I appreciate that argument, but I suspect if one called the Ohio facility, I don't know how quickly there'd be someone there to go through the prior records. There might have been. On the other hand, confronted, as Chief Judge Rakowski says, with a suggestion of a counterfeit money order, they call a headquarters where I suspect they are attuned to calls from various law enforcement agencies speaking to the issue of what we have in hand. Does this, if I give you this information, does it sound legitimate? While the route you suggest is a possible one and maybe could have been done with efficiency, maybe not, is the route they took by calling Maryland an unreasonable one?
Well, Judge, I even asked during the deposition, I asked the officer, how did he get the number to call the post office in Maryland? He could not even tell me. You know, so this is not something that he's used to doing.
Well, it's unreasonable to assume that it wasn't in the Fortville Police Department's car listing, or computer, but I assume, didn't they get that from the postal authorities in Fortville?
Well, Judge, the point here is, here they were confronted with a situation where a citizen of the United States' constitutional rights were in play. His Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures was in place. In this case, I think the best course would be to exercise reasonable care to make sure that you don't trample on this fellow's constitutional right. In this case, they did not. And what happened? Mr. So stayed in jail for 48 hours. He had to spend nearly $8,000 to extricate himself from this process. I don't think they should have allowed this man to go to suffer that much for something that they could have. If they had just, if they could call the post office in Maryland, if they could call the prosecutor's office, and they could call another post office entity in Indianapolis, I think it was very easy for them to take that receipt. But look at what they said when he produced the receipt, and we have that in the record. They said they didn't have time for that. That was disturbing. And I believe in it, in if you were to be reasonable, I mean, if the police officer was acting in a reasonable manner, they should have been able to take that number and say, okay.
We don't have in the record, do we, Mr. Conte, a replication of these images?
We did submit a replication of the image, including the receipts, that they, both for the $1,000 and the $500 receipt. We make.
No, but I mean of these images of the actual copies of the money orders.
We do, Your Honor. We do have. We did some.
One could see whether or not it appears to be Ben Franklin or not.
Well, we submit a photocopy. Right.
So you couldn't hold it up to light
right.
And try to see what Ben Franklin looked like, or whether if you turned it the right way, all of a sudden it became a hologram and turned into Jesus Christ. We don't have that.
Well, Your Honor, we don't have the actual money orders on the record, and frankly, my client was surprised to learn that, in fact, if you raise that money order to light, you can see an image here that either looks like Benjamin Franklin.
So like
Jesus
we have
Christ.
On our regular money now, if you hold it up to light, you can see things that you might not on a table.
Well, we don't have that for you, okay. Your Honor. But
just a copy.
Yeah, just copies of that. And so we believe if the court determines that, in fact, it would have been reasonable for the police officer to accept the receipt from Mr. So and at least call that post office, then the next question in this case is whether there was a deprivation of his constitutional rights. I mean, the appellees argued that there was not. But in fact, just on the thoroughfare where he was pulled over, he stayed there for about an hour and 14 minutes. And then they were parading him between two towns for about 4 hours. They would take him to Fordville. They would take him to McCourtsville. Before this whole process started around 1, he did not end up in jail until about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. It was just a very protracted transaction that was not necessary at all. So for them to argue that, in fact, there was no constitutional right implicated here in this case is not supported by the law from this circuit.
Are you asking us with that argument to set a time limit on the investigation?
Well, not set a time limit, but what is reasonable under the circumstances. We don't believe if they were calling around, if they already determined that, in fact, this fellow had committed a crime, I don't see why they were walking, parading him around the town in handcuffs for that long. I mean, they talked to the postal employees, and they indicated that, in fact, they believed the money was fake. You know, they decided to conduct their own independent investigation. When we raised that before the district court, the only thing the district court indicated was, in fact, the police did not need to investigate. Well, I don't have that case in my brief, but I found a case by reading where this court has indicated that, in fact, if there are reasonable avenues of investigation, they must be pursued, especially when it is unclear whether a crime has been committed. And that case is Bevier versus Hucom. It was decided in 1986 by this court.
What's the site? Do you have
806 Federal 2nd 123. It's a 1986 case. So we believe, Your Honor, there are other issues that were not really discussed by the district court because the entire order itself was only focused on the probable cause issue. We believe that, in fact, the police, if they were acting in a reasonable manner, should have taken that receipt. Because they started an investigation, they should have taken that receipt and called the Postal Service.
What if they had done that? Although I suspect it maybe the police officers thought if they thought that money order, Mr. Conte, was illegitimate, that maybe the receipts were not legitimate. That didn't turn out to be the case. What if they called that Ohio post office and it was either a busy signal or the person says, I don't have time to go back through the records right now and find out what occurred on whatever the date of their purchase was, which could easily, I guess you and I could understand that that could occur. If they had done that, which you suggest they should have done, and they had gotten that kind of a response, if they then proceeded down the path they did take, would you still be telling us that it was unreasonable?
Well, you know, they would have had an argument to make, Your Honor, in this case. At least they would
have held them longer, right, if they were waiting for this inquiry to be responded to from Ohio.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is they did not. That's the whole point.
I appreciate that.
Did they hold him over a weekend?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, Judge Flom's argument is, what if they said, we'll get back to you on Monday, and we'll know whether the receipt's valid or not on Monday. Should they have let him go?
Well, Judge, first of all, I don't remember the exact date. I kind of misunderstood your question there. I don't know whether it was, I think it was on a Monday. It was November 19, 2007. I'm not quite sure what the date was. But in any case, Your Honor, they did not do it. They should have just called. That was simple. You know, the number was there on the receipt, and if the court looks at the record, it will indicate that, in fact, the receipt for the $1,000 and the $500 were the same. I see my time is off a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Conte. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Your Honors. Kyle Jones, representing the McCordsville Police Department and arguing on behalf of the appellees. The district court correctly determined in this case that the McCordsville Police Department does not have the capacity to be sued. It is not a suable entity. This court has noted that, and the district courts in Indiana have likewise held such. A municipal police department is merely a vehicle through which the municipal entity performs certain functions. Under Rule 17B, 17B3, the state law where the district court is located determines whether or not a party is suable. In Indiana, as far as a governmental entity is concerned, only a unit has the authority to form and operate a government. A unit is defined as a county, a municipality, or a township. A municipal police department is none of those. So we would submit that the McCordsville Police Department is not a suable entity, as the district court held, and that summary judgment would be affirmed on that basis. That would apply to the Fortville Police Department as well. Even if they were suable entities, in this case, as I hope to point out in this argument and as pointed out in the briefs, there would still be no municipal entity liability in this case because the plaintiff cannot and did not establish any type of policy or custom that was the moving force behind any constitutional deprivation. In this case, he's asserted the claims under 1983, 1985, and 1986. With regard to the 1983 claims, his primary argument, as he has addressed here this morning, is that of false arrest. And certainly probable cause is an absolute bar to any claim for false arrest. And this is where we come into this issue of whether these statements that were provided to Officer Fuller of the Fortville Police Department by numerous representatives of the United States Post Office are hearsay. We would submit that they are not hearsay. Those statements were not being offered to prove the truth of the matter, and so does not fall within the definition of hearsay under 801C. Rather, they're simply statements provided to Officer Fuller to help establish the basis for probable cause. And in this case, there is ample evidence of probable cause. The representatives at the Fortville post office told Mr. Sow, as they told Officer Fuller, that the money order was fake, that the numbers on the money order didn't match, that the image on the money order was not appropriate. Officer Fuller, having that information, also looked at the money order that was provided to him by Mr. Sal, and it did not appear that the image on it was that of Benjamin Franklin. Officer Fuller then contacted the post office in Baltimore, Maryland. They told him that the numbers didn't match what should come from a post office. He then contacted the inspector at the Indianapolis office, again told that the numbers weren't matching what should come from the post office, and that if the image was not that of Benjamin Franklin, it was a fake money order. In addition to that, as pointed out by some of the questions earlier, Mr. Sal could not produce a receipt for the $1,000 money order. I think a comment was made, and certainly it was in the brief and perhaps in argument here this morning, that he didn't have the opportunity to look for that. I think, first off, I don't think that correctly characterizes the evidence. He had plenty of opportunity. He, in fact, was looking through his backpack. That's where he found the receipt for the $500 money order. His testimony was that there was just so many papers in that backpack, he couldn't find it.
When in that timeline was that $1,000 receipt recovered or presented? Was that after he had been released, after 48 hours of custody?
Absolutely. That was never presented to the officers at any time, the receipt for the $1,000 money order.
So after he was released on bond, I understand he was released on bond 48 hours after he had been held in custody. Sometime after that, the actual receipt was presented, and then these charges were dismissed.
Presumably, Your Honor, that is not, it's not in the record, but certainly the Fortville or McCordsville wouldn't have been a part of that after the arrest. They were done. They didn't have any further involvement with when.
Is that your understanding of it?
That is my understanding of it, yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Jones, did you represent McCordsville Police Department before Judge Young?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
I'm looking through his order, and he talks about the issue you raised relative to the Fortville Police Department. And for the exact reason you've said to this court, and he said the Fortville Police Department must be dismissed from this suit, and then he repeats that at the end, but he doesn't say anything about McCordsville. Was that presented to him?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
He just missed it in his opinion?
No, it's actually in a different order.
Okay.
And that would be in docket number 73 of the district court's order.
That's his separate order.
That is correct.
Okay,
he issued
thank you.
An order as to McCordsville, then issued one as to the Fortville defendants, and then entered judgment.
So you're here on both, even though you're only addressed in the short order.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
We addressed many of these issues in the underlying briefing before the district court. With regard to the probable cause, again, we believe that there was ample evidence of probable cause. And I think, as pointed out, the real complaint, I think, that Mr. Sal is attempting to make is that the officers didn't do a further investigation, that they didn't investigate it the way he wanted them to investigate it. But the case law is clear. Once there is the establishment of probable cause, there is absolutely no duty to further investigate. There's just simply no duty to further investigate into the crime. Probable cause was present. The district court correctly determined that and correctly granted summary judgment in that regard. One of the other 1983 claims that Mr. Sal makes is that of excessive force. He references the handcuffs and is bumping his head as he's being put into the patrol car. We believe that the district court correctly determined that the evidence there simply could not state a claim for excessive force. With regard to the handcuffing issue, I would point out that with regard to McCordsville, the only involvement of that, of a McCordsville officer, was in rolling up the sleeve of Mr. Sal as the handcuffs were being applied. He states that at a later time he made a single complaint that the handcuffs were uncomfortable. There's no evidence that he made any request for medical treatment from the officer. He didn't make any complaint at the jail. He didn't seek medical treatment at the jail. He was in jail for over 48 hours and no complaints there. We have referenced the Tibbs versus City of Chicago case that we think that addresses those issues and in which this court upheld the grant of summary judgment in that handcuffing case as well. With regard to the bump on his head, again, even in that case, there was no evidence that he even complained of that. He didn't make any request for any medical treatment to the officer. Again, he didn't make any complaint of that to the jail when he arrived there. He didn't seek medical treatment at the jail either. So we think that the district court correctly determined that there was no excessive force in this case. One of the other 1983 claims that he has asserted is the racial profiling claim under the 14th Amendment. There's simply no evidence of racial profiling in this case, and the district court correctly determined that and found that the evidence it just simply didn't support such a claim. The sum total of his evidence is that he is an African-American man arrested by white officers in a predominantly white community. And that's it. There's
I'm
nothing
assuming
else.
Assuming these are rural, small town Indiana?
It is a small town in Indiana. Both of these towns are next to each other. Populations are under 5,000, I believe. But again, there's no evidence.
And that's all we have in the record.
I don't even think you have the population in the record, Your Honor. But as the district court noted, there's simply, on those basis, to say that simply because he's an African-American man arrested by white officers in a predominantly white community, that simply doesn't state a claim for a violation of the Equal Protection Clause for any type of racial profiling. Even if there were claims of racial, or even if there were constitutional deprivations, and we would submit that the district court correctly determined that there were not. But even if there were, there's no Monell liability against the entities here in this case. There's no policy or custom that caused any constitutional deprivation.
Anybody raise qualified immunity?
Yes, Your Honor. Officer Fuller raised qualified immunity in this case. And the basis of that being, number one, there's no constitutional deprivation as we've addressed thus far. And that, secondly, even if there was a constitutional deprivation, that the law was not clearly established at the time. And when we look at whether or not it was clearly established, we're not looking at it in the general sense, but rather in a more specific sense, and that is, was it clear to the officer in relationship to the very specific facts that he was confronting, whether or not his actions were violative of Mr. Sal's constitutional rights. And we think that that qualified immunity would apply. The district court did not address that
right.
In his order, but it was raised, and Officer Fuller would submit that qualified immunity would apply to this case. With regard to the Monell claims, the essence of that is that he claims that McCordsville Police Department and Fortville Police Department had expressed policies or an implicit custom of racial profiling of people in their town. Again, no evidence of that whatsoever. The expressed policies, as set forth in the record before the court, is that McCordsville and Fortville had policies prohibiting bias-based profiling and discrimination. They both require their officers to observe and respect the civil rights of citizens. So again, there's no express policy. He then attacks the training and says, well, the training was insufficient for these officers. Again, no evidence of insufficient training in this case. The facts are that the officers, each of them, attend and graduate from the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy. At the academy, they received instruction in cultural diversity, and instruction regarding the prohibition of racial discrimination and profiling. Faced with that evidence, the appellant in this case then takes the position that, well, the officers need, or the defendants needed to produce even more evidence, that they needed to come forward with a syllabus of the classes that they took. And, of course, there's absolutely no obligation whatsoever to do that. The defendants put forth evidence of appropriate training, although they didn't need to even do that, but they did put forth evidence of appropriate training. And it is the plaintiff's burden then to come forward with evidence to establish a lack of training that led to a constitutional deprivation. So, I mean, not only is there appropriate training in this case, but certainly there's no evidence that any lack of training led to any constitutional right violation. And I think that covers the federal claims. With regard to the state claim, the only one asserted on appeal here is the claim of negligent supervision, which he has addressed in terms of negligent training. Same analysis would apply as to what we just addressed under the federal claims. There's no evidence of negligent training in this case in any manner. We would ask this court to affirm the district court's granting of summary judgment and entry of judgment in favor of the defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Conte, did he have Ms. Conte have any time remaining? He did not. Ms. Conte, you may have an additional 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, most of the arguments raised by Mr. Jones were addressed in our brief, but I needed to touch briefly on the excessive force argument here. This court has addressed that issue many times, and in fact, the case they relied on is the Tips versus the City of Chicago. Now, in that case, the arrestee was only handcuffed for about 25 minutes, and he suffered some mild discomfort. That's all that was indicated in that case. But in this case, Mr. Sowell, who is 57 years old, you know, was handcuffed for close to 5 hours. And he did testify during his deposition that, in fact, he lost consciousness when he was pushed and hit the police car. That evidence was never negated during the summary judgment proceedings. He did also testify that he suffered headaches, and then he did buy over-the-counter medication, and he received treatment while in Senegal. And none of that was contested during the summary judgment process. So there was more to his arrest than the arrestee in Tibbs. And in fact, this court has also indicated that the plaintiff need not show just physical injury in order to sustain a claim of excessive force. And the case is Byrd versus Rehnberger, where this court said you don't have to show physical force. This guy was held over there for 5 hours, and then he complained of the things that were never reported during the summary judgment process. So we believe that, in fact, he did make a claim for excessive force. Now, in terms of the municipal liability, we also submit to this court that, of course, for McCourtsville, we did not name any of the officers in their individual and official capacities, but we did name one of the police officers for Fortville. And, of course, it is clear that by naming him, the city will have to bear liability for that. I think the Supreme Court has indicated that in the case of Brandon versus Holt. So we believe we did make a case for municipal liability.
Thank you, Mr. Conte. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.